Good morning and welcome to Plugged Into Long Island on 102.3 WBAB and 106.1 BLI. I'm Allie Alley, and today we are talking to Richard Haas, the Public Outreach Chair of Long Island Teachers and also the President of the Half Hollow Hills Teachers Association. Thank you so much for joining us, Richard.
Thanks for having me, Allie.
Of course. So tell me a little bit about this. What is Long Island Teachers?
So there are somewhere around 120 districts on Long Island between Nassau and Suffolk County. Each of those has its own teachers association representing thousands and thousands of teachers across Long Island. And, within our districts, we come together as local unions and we speak with one voice on education issues and things like that. But we realized decades ago that there were common needs and common messages between Nassau and Suffolk County that Long Island as a region, has its unique needs and wants. And we basically created this coalition decades ago to come together and speak with one voice on behalf of what Long Island needs in education. So it brings us together, we meet, we get to talk about what our districts have and what we need, and it also helps us deliver that voice up to Albany, when we're speaking as well.
What are some of those shared needs from the Nassau community as well as Suffolk?
Sure. The one that sticks out the most, I think one that we really worked a lot on in recent years was around high stakes testing. That was one a few years ago that we got heavily involved in. Similar time period, the Common Core, involved in making sure that, it wasn't just politicians, but that it was teachers' voices that were brought forward when we identified what needed to be done to fix problems with the assessment system or concerns that we had over standards that were being rolled out that we didn't think were appropriate for kids developmentally. So again, without an entity like Long Island Teachers, we're each kind of just banging our own drum. Having Long Island Teachers gave us the ability to kind of come together and speak with one voice on those issues. Those are ones that were really glaring in the time that I've been here. Certainly school funding is one that comes up all the time as well. It's certainly an important issue right now, especially during the pandemic when, we're all suffering economically. So
is there a teacher shortage on Long Island right now?
So to answer that question, I think means looking at different tenure areas and different sectors within the field of teaching. There are some that are in higher demand than others based on what's happening at the state level with different laws that are being passed out or promulgated. There's certainly been an increase, I think, in special education hiring in recent years to meet the unique needs of all of our students, right? We've learned a lot more about how to do that, and that involves bringing people who are especially trained in that area in to meet their needs. A few years ago, we had new regulations passed regarding meeting the needs of language learners in all of our schools. And that led to, a pretty significant spike in hiring ESL, ELL teachers, teachers with bilingual certificates. So that's happening sometimes as a result of policies that are being passed down by the state. We do have other areas where, some of the, like supply and demand, some of the areas where there aren't a lot of positions in a district, unfortunately, you end up with not a lot of teachers looking at going into those fields. So the need for them can be really tremendous when you lose them. Technology, family and consumer sciences, those sometimes can be hard fields to hire, to find teachers for. And I think we've seen also generally across the board, it kind of happens after every wave where the profession really gets dragged down. We have them every couple of decades where the teaching profession goes through this embattled period like we did after the market collapse in 2008. When we were dealing with everything surrounding Common Core, the loss of funding, high stakes testing, you have about a half decade after something like that. The next wave of kids who are going off to college and thinking about what they want to pursue rethink going into the teaching profession because they've watched it get dragged through the mud in there, in, you know, where they were old enough to know what it was when they saw it. So I think around 2010, 2011, you saw a little bit of that happening publicly. And I think that wave of kids didn't pick teaching, right? So we've seen that effect. I know that NYSED, our state union, has created a Take a Look at Teaching program, and they've worked hard to get out to community colleges, to get into certain communities, to get to SUNY schools and really talk about teaching as a profession and try to find great candidates and remind them that it's noble work, that, you know, like any public job, you take your bruises at times, but then what we do really matters, and we need the best candidates that we can find to do it.
So. Absolutely. I'm curious, how much schooling is involved in becoming an educator?
So you have to have, in New York State, you have to have at least a master's degree to continue in the profession. That's not the same in other states in the country. We have, I think, higher standards for entering and staying in the profession than many. Most teachers, though, are lifelong learners. You know, you get in and the state requires that you continue to take professional development classes, districts require it, and we seek it out ourselves a lot too. So you have to have a master's to be in the field, but many, many, many of our teachers go well beyond that, so.
Is it different for, I guess, more specific teachers? Like if it's a language teacher or if it's a history teacher, does the level of schooling differ?
No, there's no increased level of schooling required based on tenure or what someone chooses to teach. You might have to get additional certificates to teach certain things. So if you are a social studies teacher who is going to teach a bilingual social studies class in a community that is running a program like that, you might need to have an extension certificate. There are a lot of core academic, like English, math, science, social studies teachers who have their main degrees in those content areas, but also have those special education extension certificates or ESL extension certificates. Things like that. But you don't need a higher level or a different level of your actual degree.
That kind of goes into my next question, how teachers are always looking to learn. Are there growing fields in education? Can you branch out?
Can you ask that question again?
Are there growing fields in education, like, for example, like special education or social work, physical education?
Yeah, I do think in recent years that special education and bilingual certification or ESL have been probably the largest growth we've seen.
Okay. And obviously at this time, schools, it's kind of a scary thing right now with coronavirus being so relevant. So how has public education kind of changed at this time from your perspective?
That would take a whole half hour to get started. It would take a half hour probably. But so this year I've been teaching somewhere around 20 years I've been teaching now. And if I was teaching 200 years, I'd tell you the same thing. There's never been a year like this one. We've basically had to reimagine every aspect of what we do. In that process, discovered that it's double or triple as hard as it would be in a normal year. You know, I always, when I talk with people, break teaching down into five major areas of work, right? Your planning of instruction, your delivery of instruction, the teaching part, your assessing student learning, your meeting the social and emotional needs of your children, your students in the room, and you're communicating with parents, with families, right? Those are the major components of the job. And every single one of them is twice as hard this year as it would be in a normal year. People ask when I see them which program our school district, Half Hollow Hills, is using. And I remind them that really every school district right now is running multiple programs. You've got your full live kids K through five. You've got hybrid kids 6 through 12. You've got full remote kids K through 12. And we're basically running three different school systems with one staff. And all really pretty emotionally and cognitively drained while doing it. So it's been a tough reopening. I think our teachers are working around the clock. Parents are too. Parents, kids, this is really hard on everybody involved in education, administrators, parents, kids, teachers. We're trying to make it feel like a normal year when it probably can't, but that doesn't mean we're going to stop trying. We're all, I think, trying to get a round peg into a square hole. And when you do that, you create gaps and you shred the peg a little bit. But we're doing the best we can. And I don't think I could, if I tried, I don't think I could convince people to do any less. I think our teachers are super committed to doing the best they can for their kids. And that's what we're going to do every day.
So. I know a lot of people are focused about the kids going back, but was there any pushback maybe from teachers about restarting school this year, or was it something that everyone was all on board, we need to start school this year?
I didn't get, in our district, I didn't get any pushback from teachers on returning. I think people were nervous. That's definitely an appropriate word to use. There was anxiety. What I heard when I spoke with and listened to our members was that they wanted to know that the district was doing everything that it could within reason to make sure that our schools were safe. And we did, right? If you did everything right, and I, you know, when I speak with our members, I remind them that you can never eliminate risk, right? You can just reduce it by making the right choices and doing what's within your power. And for most people, they were okay with that. Our students are socially distant. They're wearing masks. We have shields. They're behaving appropriately in halls. You know, we're doing everything we can to prevent spread and to catch cases when they arise and you know, cut them off quickly. So yeah, that truth be told, the biggest concern I hear from teachers is not about that. And I think they actually are really appreciative of the work that our district has done. The biggest part is really the sustainability of the work, really just being able to keep up at the pace we've been working for another eight, you know, however many months we're going to be operating in these hybrid modes and remote modes. So
has there been anything positive from this time that maybe you didn't expect?
Yeah, definitely. I think that we have learned more in the last 8 months professionally in terms of how to meet the unique needs of learners, how to deliver how to deliver instruction remotely, how to collaborate remotely, new methods of assessment, new methods of teaching. Like, we've learned 8 years worth of stuff in the last 8 months, right? And I am confident that we're going to carry a lot of what we learned with us when things get back to normal. I do always put a little asterisk on the end of that statement and say, of all the things that we learned, the one thing we've learned still more than anything is that this is no substitute for regular school. Because people ask, they're like, hey, have you figured out it's great to teach remotely? There is no replacement for kids being in school with teachers, you know, bonding with us, learning directly without screens in front of them. So we learned that too, but we've definitely learned a lot of useful skills, I think, along the way.
And I know some people have posed this question, is public education at risk or under attack right now? I know in these times, it may feel like it is. I'm curious on your perspective of that.
So I think that varies a little bit from year to year. I think a lot of public life, a lot of public work is under attack at any given moment by people who seek to privatize it because they look at it as a market or a sector that they could break into. I've never believed that at all. You know, I don't believe that the post office should be a market or a sector that can be broken into. I don't believe that libraries are. I don't believe that police departments are, or schools or prisons. Like, these are an important part of what makes our communities and our society work the way that they do. And there are definitely people who I think for their own benefit don't really get that, right? Or choose not to get that. And that threat is always out there, you know, that privatization threat of anything that the government or that the public does just out of public necessity. Other than that, you know, I think the biggest threat we face at any given moment has to do with funding, you know, really making sure that our schools, all our schools, have what they need to give kids the education that they deserve. And that education doesn't look dramatically different based on a kid's socioeconomic status. That's probably the greatest threat I think we face is inequity in the system that is usually a function of funding. And we see it now. We certainly see it with COVID. You know, districts that can afford to will weather this storm. You know, it'll hurt. You know, they'll take probably 10 years to recover financially from what they've had to do to get through this year. And others can barely keep their doors open. You know, there are districts really close by that have no live classes at certain levels because they just can't afford to do it. And everything is being done remotely where they can staff differently. And that is largely a function of funds. And that's probably the biggest threat, I think, to public education.
I was going to ask, have there been a lot of budget cuts in different districts across the island?
I can't speak to every district. Again, there's more than 100. I do know that because of lost funding from the state, there are districts that have had to make staffing cuts, that have had to make program cuts, that have had to look at what would have been a difficult year if everything was in place in terms of funding and you could just hire at will. If you could hire at will, build at will, buy at will, create all the rooms, hire all the teachers, buy all the PPE, this would still be a hard year, right? If you had all of the resources you need to plug through it. And we don't, right? There are definitely districts that, in addition to facing the crises they're facing, are also staring down the barrel of multi-million dollar budget cuts. Like, so what do you do when it costs an extra $6 million, I'm making up a number, but that's a pretty real number, to open your doors this September, and the state is telling you, by the way, we're taking $6 million from you. That's a $12 million hole you're looking at just to try and keep kids learning. Right. And if you're in a district that has resources, it's not pretty, but you can push through that, and other districts struggle to do it. And it's not because the administrators or the boards or the teachers or the kids or the parents, it's not because any of them did anything wrong. It's just a function of systemic inequity that makes it harder for some kids to get what others have.
How do people, is it possible to, you know, do fundraisers or to donate?
To schools? Not so much.
Or the organization, like the Long Island Teachers, is that a possibility?
I think for starters, you know, to make a dent in a public school, to raise the amount of funds that would actually impact program is like, it's a pretty Herculean effort you'd have to undertake. Like I said, I literally, again, 120 districts on Long Island, if each one is looking at a loss of anywhere between, you know, I'm just, again, ballparking numbers, 3 million, 6 million, 9 million. You know, where do you come up with numbers like that?
Right.
So it's tough. And I there are also, I believe, in New York, laws that govern fundraising and donations and how they can be handled within school districts. So that's not to say they can't take donations. I think they definitely do. But I honestly don't. I don't have any vehicle through which I can think of A, raising the funds that would make the difference, and B, getting them where they need to go before this is hopefully past us this year. So
you never know. All good hopes.
Yeah, you got to start with something, you know.
Exactly. How does the public support this organization and Long Island Teachers, though?
I'm not sure there's a direct relationship with Long Island Teachers as an entity, you know, with the coalition of us that come together and the public. Really, our local teachers associations within each district, within each community, mm-hmm. I think run their own programs where they try to engage with parents and engage with their PTAs and things like that and promote the common good. So I feel like supporting local teachers associations and obviously as an extension of that, local teachers, local educators, our SRPs, our paraprofessionals, our nurses, our librarians, that's the best support we can ask for is for parents to continue to be our partners and know that we reciprocate that relationship. We all go to bat for our schools, for our kids, and for them to be the best that they can be. So that's really, I think, where the relationship is. Like I say, Long Island Teachers was created, Long Island, decades ago to bring together Long Island district leader voices on behalf of education here. And it's really at the ground floor, at the grassroots level, that the relationships matter the most. Yeah.
So where can our listeners go to find more information on this group in general? Just before we let you go, so we make sure they can find more information.
Sure. We do have a website. Longislandteachers.org is our public page. It includes some examples of, you know, when we're out there in the media and, you know, having conversations like these, trying to raise awareness about what's happening in education. That'd be, I think, the best starting point. And also, like I say, to reach out to local teachers associations within the school districts and ask for their voices. You know, sometimes we as parents hear what our teachers say about what our individual kids need and know that they know more, but they're kind of tight-lipped about it sometimes. So I think that asking how they're doing, you know, and how school's going, I think is valuable. That's probably the best way to go.
Awesome. Last question I have for you. I missed it before, but how does a teacher get involved with their specific union or this larger union on a whole?
So again, involvement usually starts at the grassroots level, at the ground floor. We bring in new members every year, and as soon as they're done meeting district leadership, they come meet us, and we get them on board with the union, with the teachers association. And I know locally we look for really simple, really positive ways to get them involved early, to help them develop relationships within their schools, to let them know that they have somewhere to go to get questions answered and to get help when they need it. And we really encourage our members when they join and when they're hired to get involved in like some of the work that our public relations group does. For example, we support like the Scott Beagle Walk, like memorial walks. We get involved in community events like our homecoming. We encourage our members to join the PTA right away, to attend their Founders Day. Really to look for positive ways to get engaged, you know, things that aren't gonna, you know, ruffle anybody's feathers because they're it's all goodwill. You know, our social justice committee is doing a lot to raise awareness around issues. So I would take a young, you know, 22, 23-year-old teacher just entering the profession who wants to get involved but is a little nervous about being too out there. And I would say that those are not only safe things for them to do to get involved, they're actually wonderful ways to show that they are looking to become a part of the fabric of where they work and that they stand for something. So we really encourage members early to get involved in things like that.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much, Richard, for joining us today and giving us a little insight on education right now.
All right. Thank you for having me, Allie.
Of course. And thank you guys so much for tuning in to Plugged Into Long Island on 102.3 WBAB and 106.1 BLI.